Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
As families come together for the Passover and Easter holidays, many of their annual holiday celebrations will be centered around food. In fact, food is at the center of many of our family traditions, from birthdays to movie night. Our next guests say you'd be surprised how much our everyday lives and relationships are shaped by food. Carolyn M. Grant and Lisa Catherine Harper are the editors of the new book, The Cassoulet Saved Our Marriage, True Tales of Food, Family, and How We Learn to Eat. Ladies, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
So we also want to hear from listeners on this. Do you have a family food tradition that's more than just a recipe? Maybe it's your mom's Passover brisket or grandma's beloved red sauce. Maybe you call it gravy. Why is it so special? Call us now and let us know. The number here is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. It doesn't have to be a recipe or even a holiday like Passover or Easter. Maybe you have a summer clam bake or an annual barbecue where family and friends come together. What makes it about more than just good food? 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. This book has 29 essays and 29 writers, with each writer looking at why exactly family food matters. So how did you come to this work, to work on this project? Either of you?
We met when Lisa submitted an essay to a website I was editing, Literary Mama. And as we worked on the essay and our editorial correspondence turned into friendship, we realized we had a real passion for food and interest in this subject. And she suggested to me one day that we come up with this anthology. She had the title in her mind, Learning to Eat. And so we got together at the playground with our kids one day to talk about what the book could be. Maybe I'll let Lisa tell the rest of the story.
Hey, Lisa. And we took out our lunches, and Carolyn's a vegetarian, and my family is not, and Carolyn's family eats dinner together every night, and my family not so much. But we realized, you know, there was a much bigger story here than the kind of food that we put in front of our kids. There's a lot of talk about what we eat, what we should be feeding our kids, and how we should be cooking. But what we really wanted to talk about was a broader conversation, not just what gets put on our kids' plates, not just the healthy, local, organic, sustainable conversation that's well covered elsewhere and that can make us very anxious and very judgmental about family food, but we wanted to talk about who we're feeding, why we're feeding them, and what food really means. So we wanted to have a broader conversation, not about sustainable food, but about creating a sustainable family food culture. And that's really where the book came from, is this idea of moving away from judgment.
So you divide the book into three parts: food, family, and learning to eat. And so I want to start with that first section, food. And you say in the intro, food, whether or not it's healthy or homemade, can make the family. How so, Caroline?
Well, it's a matter of connecting with that single dish, whether it's, you know, oysters that you share with your partner the first night in a new city, or a cake that you make together. It's really elemental, the food that we share together.
Because they can really, I mean, an experience like that, you know, sharing oysters and the city where you travel to can really imprint a memory on your mind and years later.
Yeah, and we have a great there's a great essay in that section by Adisha Filia about soul food and the kinds of food that she grew up eating that were cooked by and how she learned to cook with her grandmother and her mother, you know, really delicious fried chicken and long simmered collard greens that her kids knew nothing about because of the health issues that she was concerned about. So what she's done to keep them connected to their food traditions, regional traditions, and also very specifically to her mother and her grandmother, they have soul food night once a month instead of every day.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I can relate to that because my mom used to make, hold on for this, pig ears in this delicious red sauce, which she served with rice and beans that was delicious. But I think once I turned 16, she never made it again.
And you missed it probably, right?
Now knowing, as I think of the concept of pig ears, probably not so much. But I do remember, specific times when she made it and how it very much, even now I look back on it and it resonates with me.
And it's a great story, right? And similarly in that section, and I know you put on your website the recipe for Barbara Rushkoff's mother's brisket. And, you know, I saw that even one of your listeners commented, like, brisket roasted with a can of Coke? Like, who would make that?
Right.
It's maybe not how you would make brisket, but it's a great story.
Right. All right, let's take a couple calls. Go ahead.
So I was going to say, and that's the thing, you know, food is partly about the dish, but it's also about the relationships that are formed around the table, you know, because we, you know, for kids, all food is family food up to, a pretty significant age. And so they remember certainly what they eat, but they also remember how they learn to talk around the table, whether they learn to serve, whether they learn to clear the table or set the table. All of those things are part of what our families do together and what our families teach our kids. So we could all bring home the same beautiful bag of, you know, fresh, local, organic, healthy groceries, but we're all going to do something different with that.
Right.
And if we don't have a sustainable food culture, whatever that means for your family, it doesn't really matter what you're cooking.
And that even applies to when you go out to eat as well. I mean, you have a favorite restaurant. Yeah. Let's take a couple calls here. Ken is in Inwood. Ken, welcome to the program.
Hi. I have two memories of my dad. He made a breakfast for me every single day, eggs and oatmeal. And he was a Holocaust survivor, so food meant so much to him. And shopping on the weekends for vegetables and appetizers and the care. And anytime I'm depressed, I just go shopping for vegetables, you know?
Excellent. Ken, thanks very much for your call. That's a great point.
It reminds me of the essay by Bethany Saltman in our book, and it's another holiday essay in some respects. She's writing about Thanksgiving and making her father's gravy recipe and how it allows her to connect with her late father and sort of redeem their relationship, which was a little bit fraught when he was alive, but now making his gravy and thinking about him, she feels warmer toward him, more connected toward him.
Interesting. You know, talking about food, my mom cooked for 11 children her entire life. And so turning one chicken into individualized meals, you know, you got to, that really imprints on your mind when you see someone doing that kind of work in the kitchen. Let's go to Alexa.
The economy of it, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Alexa in Forest Hills.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm really interested in buying this book, so thanks for this segment.
Sure.
I wanted to talk about my grandmother, who was an incredible baker, and I grew up eating all of her different holiday cookies. She made one in particular that was a jam bar called a sweet pizza, which had a kind of crumbly crust. She always told me how to make it, but never really wrote down exactly the recipe and kind of explained with her hands to rub them together, this is how you make the crust. This is how you make the crumble. And she unfortunately passed away at the end of last year, but I've been making it so often since then and trying to rub my hands together, but just since she didn't write down exactly what she did, I'll never make it exactly like she did.
You're going to have to keep experimenting with that recipe.
My pleasure.
Yeah, for generations. I mean, I'm so glad these callers have mentioned their father and their grandmother because, you know, there's so much pressure right now on, I think it's usually the mother who's doing the shopping and the cooking, but the essays in our book and your callers are testifying to the fact that it really isn't just mothers who influence the family food culture. Dads can be really, really important. Brothers are important. Grandmothers are important as well. It really is a multifaceted, multidimensional part of the family.
There's an essay in this section by Sarah Shea called An American Omelet in Brooklyn that may strike a chord with a New York audience. It talks about how food can help to bridge cultural differences. Can you talk about that a little bit, Lisa?
Sure. Sarah Shea grew up on a Midwestern farm where there was a tradition of always feeding the workers. They would come and the men would come and they would bring in the harvest. And she and her mother and her grandmother, I think it was, did all, spend all day preparing breakfast and lunch for them. And when a group of Polish workers showed up in her brownstone to fix the cornices, she wanted to help feed them. And the interesting thing is that she had actually spent some time teaching English in Poland, and she started baking for them and leaving out, and this, because this is what she knew to do. And so she brought some of her Midwestern childhood and Midwestern traditions to this Brooklyn brownstone, and she fed them every day, and she played some tricks on them when they didn't like her food and left it. She did things like bake them one chocolate chip cookie and slid it into 12 parts. But it was this wonderful kind of cross-cultural creation of really a community that went on for months and months and months.
And food can really...
Brooklyn brownstone. Food, her neighbors thought she was crazy.
Food can really bridge those gaps.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a perfect way to say hello to someone or thank you to someone. Let's get another call in here. Mike is in Oakland Gardens. Mike, welcome to the program. I'm guessing that Mike is there. Is he? Hello, Mike.
Hi.
Go ahead with your question, Mike.
Great. So, yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about my family. First of all, I love my grandma and mom's noodle cook. I just have to say that. But what I'm calling about is how my family sometimes absorbs recipes and makes them family recipes. For example, a famous one, my mom got the recipe for Junior's cheesecake from the obituary of the founder. And has perfected it over time, actually gotten tips about adding a water bath. And now that's a family recipe that we use all the time.
Nice.
That's a great story. We have a beautiful essay in the book by Chris Malcolm about his family's Italian restaurant in Boston, Giovelli's, and the sauce that they make there that's a part of so many dishes on the menu, this long-simmered red sauce. And his mother once, asked for the recipe, and, of course, it calls for 20 pounds of bones and 50 pounds of meat. And she spent years trying to adapt it for home use. And, she keeps the original recipe between the leaves of the Bible.
Wow.
But also now makes it herself, has adapted it for herself, and added an ingredient that her forebears would never have put in their red sauce. So it's a beautiful story, both of how we adapt recipes for our own sort of times and traditions.
Right. This section also features both of your contributions to the book. Carolyn, you talk about your experience volunteering in your child's school cafeteria. What did you learn while you were there?
I learned to let go. I think we talk about the anxiety we have around food today, and I think maybe nowhere more than around our children's lunch, because it's the first place they're eating independently. My kids don't pack a lunch. They eat the lunch offered to them in the cafeteria. And I was really anxious about them making proper choices, even though when I was in elementary school, I made some, frankly, terrible lunch choices. I ate French fries and coconut ice cream for a year. I thrived on that, and my mother saw that. That's what she saw, that I was eating a good breakfast and a great dinner and coming home from school happily every day.
So you were cool enough to let go and let your kids eat whatever they were going to eat at school?
And I finally have learned to let go and just let them eat what they will. It's such an important part of learning to eat, is letting your kids make these independent choices.
Lisa, your essay delves into the insight into life that years of shopping at local farmers markets has bestowed upon you. What have you learned?
Yeah, well, what I learned was, I started shopping at farmers markets because I loved going. I loved meeting the farmers. I grew up in New Jersey where the growing season is very, very, very short.
Right.
And so we didn't really tend to eat very locally or very seasonally, although we did have certain things we ate at certain times of the year. But when my kids were about, 6 and 4, they had just had enough. They said, "We don't want to go to the market." They threw what I call the great market mutiny. And, we went from having these lovely Sunday mornings at the market to lots of whining, lots of complaining, lots of foot dragging. And, it's a chore. It's become, even though it's beautiful and wonderful and the food is unparalleled and we can get fresh produce every single week all year long here in Northern California, it really lost some of its bloom after all those years of going to the market over and over with the kids. And so I tried to stay away. But what I realized, you know, after about a month of not going to the market was that, you know, the market taught me a lot about slowing down and being in the moment and appreciating what comes and goes, appreciating, you know, what I can get, you know, in the moment, not just out of the food, but out of my family's life as well. I think it teaches me patience, and I think it teaches me to make the most of what's available, whether that's an orange, you know, that's on my orange tree, or whether that's those are the apples that come in the fall, or whether it's, you know, the persimmons that are only here for a few months in the
right.
spring, that, you know, working with those cycles is also the way that I aspire to parenting. I don't always parent that way, of course, but that's what I try to do.
All right, let me get one more call in here. Mia is in Queens. Mia, welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling about our family, who usually enjoys our summers in Long Island, and they're usually built around diving for conch, digging for clams, collecting mussels, and, of course, eating seafood like cioppino every night. Recently, my aunt had a sudden and unexpected allergic reaction to shellfish, and we were all really scared and wondered what would happen to the summertime if you had to remove shellfish. So my uncle, like, half-joked that he might have to consider a divorce if something like this actually came to be, but it turned out that it was just a strange, like, medication-related reaction, easily eliminated by changing the medication. But we were all really scared for a little while that there are going to be some major life changes.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Mia, thank you for your call. Carolyn M. Grant and Lisa Catherine Harper are the editors of the new book, The Cassoulet Saved Our Marriage, True Tales of Food, Family, and How We Learn to Eat. You can check out some of the recipes on the website. Go to WNYC.org. Click on The Brian Lehrer Show. Carolyn, Lisa, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
David Cruz from Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all again tomorrow.